handle the truth. Should we or should we not follow the advice of the galactically stupid?
Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe fuck yourself.
You're all a bunch of fucking assholes. You know why? You don't have the guts to be what you want to be. You need people like me. You need people like me so you can point your fucking fingers and say, that's the bad guy.
Clearly, don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No. I am the one who knocks.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Righteous Prick Podcast. I'm your host, J.L. Covan. It is 11 a.m., Monday, March 8th, in the year of our Lord, 2021. And I just had tea and nuts, day one, take 497 of my diet, beginneth today. So we're on an early lunch break. We started work early. I have a second computer open right now. I will try not to be too distracted, but I had heard that Target might be selling PlayStation 5s today. And contrary to my joke about PlayStation 5 for my nephew for Christmas, I tried. I got him a PlayStation 5 game as a placeholder, but my brother is giving me grief. He's a very regimented person, and he's like, I think I may just want to get him an Xbox or a PS4 just so we fulfill our promise to him to let him have a game system. And I'm going, that is so Republican of you to be worried about this fiscal quarter when I'm trying to get him the game system of the future that will last him through college. And you're trying to get him something for now. You're trying to get him the coal mining video game system of today. And I'm trying to get him the fusion-powered solar wind video game system of tomorrow. So I've got the Target website up. I'm sure I won't get one. Maybe it's a hoax. Maybe it's an internet hoax. But it's awfully pathetic. All I want is my wish list over the last year, a vaccine, an agent, and a PS5 in that order, and I am 0-3. And none seem to be forthcoming anytime soon for me. So a lot of frustration here at Righteous Brick Studios, but let's get to our agenda, shall we? Guys, off the bat, thank you for your feedback. A lot of comments on the Podomatic page, mostly from diehard loyalists, not as much engagement as I had hoped in terms of people just offering their opinions on the episode. But here's the point for those. Hopefully you listened last week. Our listens were significantly up last week, so that was a great sign. So hopefully a lot of you stayed with me this week who just listened for the first time or the first time in a while. You can subscribe. You know, I subscribe on Apple Podcasts to my podcast, except for The Black Guy Who Tips, which is Spotify exclusive. So I have the Spotify app on my iPod for that podcast. But those are the two main places people seem to listen to podcasts, and that's where I listen to podcasts. But I would just ask you, as I try to sort of, my Righteous Prick had its all-time highest ranking on Podomatic's comedy chart, 11, which gave me the number 3 and number 11 podcasts on their comedy charts. So that's nice. And some of that was the engagement. So if once again, I just want to reiterate, I don't have a website for Righteous Prick. I have my own website, but that's not a podcast website. So what I would ask is if you have feedback, If you have comments, if you want to discuss or just let me know something for the next week's episode, whatever, a multitude of reasons, I would ask that you become a follower on the Podomatic page. Even all you get basically by following is an email once a week telling you that the new episode is available. But what it allows you to also do is comment on the weekly episodes. And what I'd like, for both engagement reasons, algorithmically, and also engagement reasons for me, for feedback and content, is to use that site as the sort of chat, or at least one-way chat between you and I, for whatever your opinion on the episode was, for whatever suggestions you have. So a lot of people obviously did comment. I had like 12 or 13 comments. I'd love for that to be regular and honestly a lot more. But based on the feedback last week, I haven't decided if I'm going to do a sort of Patreon type subscription service yet. But if I do, the price would be $7 a month. That's on the low end of what everybody seemed to be willing to pay. So I feel like that's a good compromise amount. Now, my issue, as I said last week, is that if I do that, I would feel obligated to produce, you know, the equivalent of probably doubling your content each month for $7. So it's a good value. But for me to want to do that, I'd need to know that I have, you know, a minimum of, and this isn't any pressure because it's, all of you are just individuals listening, but I would feel like I'd need a minimum of 250 people to be sort of subscribed. And I don't think that I would get that. So I don't think paywall stuff is that likely. Just because I don't, like I said last week, I don't really feel like milking my most loyal fans for more. Even though, you know, many of you seem willing to pay for it and appreciate what I do, and I thank you for that. But I think it's unlikely because I'm not at that point in my career anymore where I just want to offer up ways for me to feel like a failure. You know what I mean? Like there are various things we did with Making Podcasts Great Again that I was hesitant to do for various reasons, selling t-shirts for our show, doing a live show too early, and both kind of flopped. And I think a lot of that had to do with COVID, a lot of that. But my instincts are usually always correct. And I know I'm really good and I know I have a lot of good stuff to share, but it's always like these opportunities to be like, all right, guys, so I'm giving you all this great stuff and we have 29 subscribers. God, I feel like an unnecessary fail is what it feels like, because as I've written extensively, I don't really trust most fans. No offense. You guys, of course, I trust, just not the other people listening. So that's still a to be determined. Needless to say, what I'd really like to do is headline clubs, sell albums, sell a TV show, do a special, and not worry about, I want people's money to be, I subscribe to Showtime or to Netflix or to HBO Max to see your special. That's what I'd like. Not to have to just be like, guys, you get Patreon for more bonus, blah, 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 blah. But at the same time, you know, the whole point of all this free stuff is, you know, there's got to be a pay at the end of the day. And if you're a fan of a comedian, you sort of hope that albums get bought and that tickets get bought when there's shows in your area. But that even seems to be not always the case. An example, my Trump album, which sold a lot of copies for a comedy album these days. It was the number one seller on Amazon and iTunes comedy charts for the month of May in 2020. But you just look at my numbers in terms of how many people like my Trump impression, how viral it went. Between both my Trump albums, because a bunch of people bought the first one, which isn't nearly as good as the second, but I sold like, I would say, and if you hear anything licking, it's not a rap video interlude of oral sex, it's Cookie drinking lots of water. But I sold, I don't know what the streams were, obviously the streams were more, but I sold between the two albums probably like 700 Trump albums in 2020, 700. And that's off of 140,000 Twitter subscribers and millions of views. I sold 700 albums. And the truth is, that may sound sad, but those are good numbers. Like I said, Fireside Crap's The Deuce debuted at number 34 on the entire iTunes chart, not on the comedy chart, on all of iTunes. So people obviously accept that the upper echelons of music and celebrity don't really buy albums. But that was one of those things where it was like, damn, that was disappointing. Like, and that's good sales, but that was really disappointing because it was just like, I don't understand. It's just a reality. It's an unfortunate reality, and you can want it to be different, but the fact remains, if you were either not famous or not like a Billboard topping artist, they're just going to stream what they want. They might watch your video. They want the comedy is such a I don't even know how to describe it, to be honest. It's such a disposable thing to people, no matter whether you're doing something super, super dumb, like walking down the street, talking in your own voice and with like two jokes, but it's like simple, accessible shit. Or if you're creating intricate sketches that require tons of editing and acting and whatever, or anything in between, people sort of now feels like they treat it with the same disregard or regard. Like it's just like, oh yeah, that's okay. Move on, next. Just distract me. Comedy, please be a distraction, not a substantive art form. So when I sold 700, I really thought I was going to sell. Me and the producer, we really did believe we were going to get four digits. Like, it would have required me, at the time the album came out, I did not have 100, but it would have required me selling the album to less than 1% of my followers who had followed me, or I'm sorry, less than 2%. You know, let's say I had like 70,000 followers at the time, to sell 1,000 albums. And those were 66,000 of those followers were people who had followed me after my Trump impression blew up. So you would have expected like at least 2%. I would have really been like, I hope like 10% of these people, because it was like literally giving them a pure, highly produced, great version of the thing that they had become a fan of. And it didn't work. So, and that's just, it gives you a little bit of despair as a comedian, because you're like, what else? Like, this was as targeted as possible. That's why when people say to me, do you do a special on your YouTube and put it out? I mean, I'd be like, well, here's what it will be. I'm going to put out a great new album or hour this year. That is a done deal. Like, that is happening and it will be great. And then if I put it on YouTube for free, if I spend like $3,000 to produce it and I put it on YouTube and it gets 8,200 views or 17,000 views, I will be depressed. Not because it's like, oh, I'm going to make my money back, but it'll be like, I am literally giving my best comedy work for free and it's not being consumed, that's a different than somebody saying, I watched it and didn't like it. That's like people still can't even be bothered to watch it. That would hurt me, because it makes you, once again, the common theme this year really of my podcast is despair, not over industry. Industry has ignored me for many years and they continue to do so. And I'm sort of callous to it. It annoys me because I want my career to move forward. But at some point you'll go insane. I was basically prepared to quit comedy until all this blew up, because there's only so many times you can just be like, but I should be doing well and I should have this. And it's like, okay, but I don't. And if I'm going to find some happiness, my analogy for those of you that are different, newer listeners, is my parents fought a lot my entire life. And for most of my adolescence, one of my mom's big complaints about my dad, my dad's employment record, he was older than my mom, and he was also, he had a spottier employment record than my mom, who work is like my mom's like oxygen. And he wouldn't make the bed. Like, she would be out the door and she'd come home from work and the bed would still be unmade. And my dad, you know, took a sort of aristocratic view of housekeeping work, which was like a maid makes the bed. A man does not. Like, I know, very old fashioned. And for anybody who's triggered, yes, a Haitian man born in 1931 had some regressive views on things. but after a while, and it wasn't really until I started going to therapy, realizing my own repetitive mistakes, that, at some point, my mom kept, it was not that my mom was wrong. My mom made it clear that like coming home to a tidy apartment or a bedroom would make her happy. She didn't want to get home from work and see an unmade bed and messy apartment. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, of course. And in a healthy, normal marriage, I think there'd be a fair distribution of labor and hopefully a lot less fighting and cursing. But at some point, and I remember saying to my mom, probably in my 20s, hey, he's not making the bed. Like not saying he's right, but in other words, saying at some point, maybe you need to move on for your own, just for your own happiness. Give that up so that, but my mom is one of those people, it's the fight, you know, the fight is half the motivation, half the energy comes from having something to argue with, something to be annoyed with. And I'm not dismissing that it was justifiable. I'm just saying at some point you got to decide, like, maybe giving up this argument will be better for me. And that's how I kind of felt about comedy in 2019. I was just like, you know what? I'm not getting the bookings. I don't get the, my work hasn't gotten the widespread acclaim or respect that it gets acclaim, but it never got widespread enough for that to matter. And, you know, that's why I'm podcasting out of an apartment in Jersey, because part of me had said it's just time to move on, not to give it up, but to give up the prioritization of comedy, because it's making me unhappy and I don't seem to be able to do anything about it. And for me, it was easier to be like, oh, the industry. And then I finally gave up on the industry, even though I'm still trying to curry their favor and get somebody to rep me, so be it. But the idea of having to give up on the fans, that the culture around comedy is that it's so disposable and so meaningless to so many people, other than just as a distraction. Like, comedy has become distraction, not art, it feels like. Like, give me things I can consume in 60-second bites, unless you're super famous, and then I'll watch your special, because then it's kind of about me. It's like I'm engaging in the it thing right now. Like, if you're in between, if you're not super famous, but you're putting out really good work, it's almost a waste of your labor. Like, either be super famous and work hard because people will respect your work because it's coming from a legend or a famous person or an it person of the moment, or make very cheap, easily consumable, simple bits online with taking up no effort and getting the same respect, if not more, as the person who's putting in tons of effort but isn't at that famous level. Like, in other words, there's the fame level. Work hard. It's going to be rewarded. And then there's the level below that, which is just like you can do something simple and stupid and probably get the same reward as somebody who's busting their ass, working really hard. Therein lies sort of a crapshoot on how people respect it. And comedy just, and that's a much tougher thing for me to absorb, because it's no longer industry keeping, even though they haven't welcomed me or called me or done anything, the amorphous industry. But when the fan base, when the audience, when the culture is so dismissive of the substance of comedy and what great comedy is and the work that goes into it and why it should be bought or paid for or embraced or supported, you're like, well, then there's no one else. Then I am just, you know, my mom yelling about make the bed. It's me just yelling, please support my comedy because it's really good. Why do I have to tell people that this is how you support comedy? Like, not, when people would say, can I donate to you? I was just like, no, this isn't one of those things. This isn't, I'm not a charity. And I know you don't mean it like that, but it's like, no, someone has to stand the same way I lecture fans online about how stupid they are with comedy. Somebody has to just say, no. You like my comedy? Then we need to have a renaissance of what you do when you like someone's art. You don't tip them arbitrarily. You don't ignore that. You buy their art. You buy their work. You tell friends about the work. You go to see them perform or do. That is the way you support art and comedians. And I don't, there's so many people now who didn't come up, who don't have those ambitions of like, I'm going to headline comedy clubs. Their ambition is I want to go viral. So it's like, their relationship to that is so different and warped. And if we allow that to be the dominant sort of exchange of ideas and art, is like, hey, great free stuff. Can I give you $10 on PayPal just cause? Then you negate that. No. buy my album when it comes out. That's the way you support. Like, it's almost like you're fighting such a big battle if you're trying to like either stop the momentum of people disregarding the value of comedy or trying to re-educate people or educate people for the first time on, hey, in society for centuries, if you liked art, you bought it. And you went to see that person perform if you could. Not, and it's, I don't know. Like, and that bothers me so much more because after that, there is nothing to perform for. If the industry doesn't embrace you and the audience is so uncultured in terms of how to support art and what actually is good art and shitty art, then I'm a guy in my apartment talking to nobody. I know I'm not talking to nobody, but you understand, I think, what I'm saying. And that is a deeper despair than just, no, I don't have an agent. Why won't they show me some respect? Why doesn't anybody want to rep me? That's one kind of despair. But when it's like, oh, and your fans don't even buy your, like the fans you already have don't even buy, or I'm not talking about you guys necessarily, but I'm just saying that you can imagine that's a much deeper despair because you're saying, well, who gives a fuck about getting an agent when the fans I already have don't even have an appropriate artist-fan relationship, if I can call it that. You know what I mean? Like, so that's, and I've talked about this for a while, but that is my deeper, deeper despair. But that said, before we get to this week's topics, and I am talking about my, I am defending the first person, just to give you a little preview, and it'll be in the show notes, the first person of, this whole idea of, people misinterpreted, I think, of me just going to talk about unknown comedians. That's not what I'm doing. Eric Myers was a relatively unknown comedian, so he inspired this. But this is about me just defending things or encouraging things that I find hysterical that I don't think get their due. So it's going to be some movies. It's going to be some comedians. It's going to be some actors. It's going to be some shows. This will probably be like a 7 or 8 week segment. And this week's will be Dane Cook, and I'll explain why he is the person I'm defending. The comedy, I don't know, comedy defender segment of the show, but we'll get to that a little later. But what I want to ask you guys, and I thought this would be a much better usage of your money and my time and my frustration, instead of, buying stuff from me this month, obviously if you want a cameo, by all means, buy one, but I am raising money and I'm putting my link into the show notes. It's my specific fundraising link, but I'm raising money for Hope for Haiti. And I think I alluded to it last week. And people have already been very generous. I'm already over $1,000. My goal is really like as much as I can raise, more than 5,000, but I felt 5,000 was a good measure, whatever, you get my point. A good benchmark. There you go. So what I would ask is that this month, since this podcast is free, even though freedom isn't, I would ask that you donate whatever you can. I mean, obviously, if every listener to this podcast donated $5, I would literally raise the money that I need, like in a week, to meet the 5,000. But what I would ask is, if you can, that's what I'd ask for. That would make me very happy, and that would obviously be if you're somebody who's inclined to donate, that's where I'd like you to donate this month. So I will include my link for Hope for Haiti. They work with in Haiti basically on education and health initiatives, and they have a Hike for Haiti challenge, which. I will talk about more in April when I am participating in it. But it's a great, very reputable charity, 4 stars on Charity Navigator. It's got like a 95% rating or something in terms of where funds go. It's a legitimate great charity, and they asked me to be an ambassador for it because I have like a big social media following, I guess, and because I gave them a shitload of money last year. So this week, I guess all I would ask is that you donate $5 if you want to give more than $5, but obviously like a Patreon, nobody has to give more than five, but if all of you give five, that would be amazing. But obviously, if you want to give more, and I'm sure plenty of people won't give it all, but you know, every amount counts. So it would be very meaningful to me and very helpful if you could do that. So that would be my pitch this week, and really this month. That's all. I have no shows this month. I can't make my new album yet. My videos are still free. So that's what I would ask you. And on Tuesday, when many of you will probably listen to this, if not later in the week or possibly Monday night, my Malcolm Gladwell video goes up. So if you want some way to support me, and this is one of those weird things where I'm always like, please, if you could do this, I would appreciate it. But I do want to see the kind of reach and interaction with this podcast, if I'm being honest. So, you know, I'm going to post it on Facebook, on YouTube, and on Twitter. And if you could share it, like it, it would be very meaningful to me too, as well. So the only money I want you to give this month is to Hope for Haiti. That in terms of money that I'm affiliated with, give money to Hope for Haiti, and please use the link I put in my my show notes. And it's also my pinned tweet if you follow me on Twitter. My direct link, but also let's maybe see if we can get that Malcolm Gladwell video seen by more people, because my YouTube engagement is dipping. Weirdly enough, I guess when people follow you for Trump stuff, the algorithm then just assumes, just like Twitter assumes, that you are only good for Trump. And meanwhile, I'm trying to have people see all the other things I do, and you guys obviously probably do. So if you could, you know, retweet, Facebook share, like on YouTube that Malcolm Gladwell video this week. Also, greatly appreciated, and obviously that costs you nothing. So that's my pitches for the week. I think that's good enough, right? Charity and a free YouTube video. I hope that you guys are down with that. I would appreciate it greatly as my hardcore fans. I wrote a blog this weekend that's been very well received and shared a lot, called Joking While Half Black. And I think I'll let that blog speak for itself. I think it's worth your time to read, so I hope you do. And also I want to throw up some prayers for Pepe Le Pew, who's being canceled. I think it's long past due that he get canceled. I just think they're canceling him for the wrong reason. I think they're claiming, you know, rape culture or something, or sexual harassment is why he's being canceled. I think he's being canceled. I think it's a very subtle message against trans people, because every cat that he tried to hook up with had a white stripe. So it was almost like they were trans skunks. And I think that he was embracing them. He wasn't ashamed to love other species. You know, they didn't smell. They weren't what a conservative cis bigot would call a quote unquote real skunk. They weren't cis skunks, but he embraced them nonetheless and showered them with affection. And if you can't accept that in 2021, then maybe this isn't the right podcast for you. So prayers up for Pepe Le Pew. I do have my list of things that I want to talk that for this series, this defending comedy series. And I'm trying to think if I have anything else. Maybe this will be it won't be too short an episode, but it'll be a lot shorter than last week. Since it's basically just been an infomercial for my YouTube and charity fundraising. But let's, you know what? Let's just, I talked a long time last week. So why don't we, I've told you where you can go to find stuff. The Malcolm Gladwell video, I'm very proud of. Hope for Haiti, I'm very motivated and proud of. And the blog. So you there, about $5 and read the blog and share the Malcolm Gladwell video on Tuesday or Wednesday. That's what I ask, okay, on one of those platforms. Because I need more people hitting the retweet and the share button. People, like, if you like my stuff, I need you guys, with no agent and with algorithms hurting me. What I'm saying to you guys is your shares and your promotion is more valuable to me at this point than any money you could give me. So there's no need for me to ask you to buy any paywall stuff or buy any albums, although you should. The only money I want you to give is to Hope for Haiti, if worried about me, and share more shares and retweets. Likes are appreciated and they help, but email to friends. I think the Malcolm Gladwell one, I'm sure it'll flop like most of my videos, but I'm very proud of it, and I even impressed the righteous girlfriend who was like, I think you're only doing this one for you. And that is an interesting thing because she's right. Most of my comedy is for me. It's what I think is funny. I don't do things that I don't think are funny if I think other people, like there's a lot of performers out there who will do content because they think it will go viral or they think it's what people want. As long as no one's paying me, I'm going to do the content I think is funny and trust my instincts and hope and pray to the algorithms that my audience sees it. But I'm not a big fan. Like if somebody wants to pay me to write for a show, then I'll write what you want written. But if it's free, I will just do what I want and trust myself. Cause what's the point in doing comedy or art if you're not doing it? And there's a lot of people I think who do things to get clout or fame or virality, but that's not what I'm doing comedy for. I'm doing comedy so I can be a comedian and share my jokes and convince people that what I have to say is entertaining and funny, not delivering to them. I'm not McDonald's, you know, I'm a fucking fancy ass, small business restaurant that wants you to enjoy my signature dishes. Okay. But I think we're done doing self-promotion. So let's talk about Dane Cook, guys. In the first in this series of JL's Comedy Defender. Now, I have mocked Dane Cook on this very podcast. I think in this new iteration that's a little over a year old, but many times on the old iteration of Making Podcasts Great Again, I had a segment called Moment of Dane, where I would read very lofty run-on sentences from Dane Cook's Instagram, which would always be these... I once called it like, oh no, this is what happens when a Boston comic lives in LA too long. It was very, we have to have the right energy. We need to put out positive energy, and I think it will come back in spades. I think when somebody gives you positive energy, you've got to feel it, and you've got to generate it, and you've got to deliver it back to the people. Force multiply. Like it was like, oh God, somebody took one meditation class and fucked a 23-year-old, and they're like, I see the world in a different way. So I mocked him. But here's the truth. Here, I'm going to explain my relation. I don't have a relationship with Dane Cook, but my relationship with Dane Cook's comedy. When I was first getting into comedy, Dane Cook was one of those names I kept hearing, and I remember watching his Comedy Central Presents. And I watched it once, and I didn't really dig it. I was like, this guy's the big thing? But I watched it a second time, just for whatever reason. And all of a sudden, I found it really funny. And what I've said about Dane Cook is I think his first half-hour special, where he's strutting around in his tank top, doing just goofy stuff, it's more about rock star confidence than maybe super sharp writing. But he was very, very popular, becoming sort of a, like, he was the classic sort of rock and roll star in comedy, which is like, he's not the most handsome guy, but the charisma and making you laugh and the fuck it, I'm out here kind of attitude. But without being his comedy didn't punch down, to use a common term. It was just, it was its own thing. And the truth is, whether you like Dane Cook or not, he was his own thing. And that alone deserves some respect for just being sort of a one of one. There were many people who seemed to copy him after. I saw it at many open mics and bringer shows. But he was a one of one, as far as I know in my general knowledge of stand-up comedy. And I remember I probably my interest in him peaked probably around 2002, maybe 2004. And then I think what was happening was he became so big that his management team probably became gluttonous, and he was putting out like a big arena hour every 18 months, and he starred in like 5 movies in 1 year, and most of them sucked. The one that was good, My Best Friend's Girl, I think was the name of it, was actually a really funny movie. I think that's the name of it. It's the one with Jason Biggs and Alec Baldwin, I think. That was actually a really funny movie. I think Kate Hudson, too. But he had been in like 4 rushed garbage comedies before then. So like by the time he was in a legitimately funny comedy, he'd already like faded his like star. He was already kind of viewed as sort of a bust. But I remember I went on a date with a woman to Caroline's, and I dropped like 50 a ticket. Cause that's basically when you're maxed out, you've got to do theaters. If you're charging 50 or more, you're almost done with comedy clubs. You're basically like, you might as well just do a theater and charge 80. But I remember I went and she was late and that annoyed me. And I think it was, I think that was our last date. Oddly enough, I saw her married in the New York Times like last year, sometime in 2020. So I was like, oh, look at that. A blast from the past. But yeah, we met at a bar, and then like on a second date, I was like, you want to go see Dane Cook? She's like, oh, I like Dane Cook. And I was like, cool. So she was late. So we had the last table in Caroline's, which meant they had to basically construct a new table in the literal back corner of the club. And I was, you know what? This is my thing is like, this was not cameo mogul JL. This was, I'm working for the DA's office, living with my parents so I can pay off my student loans quickly. Take that, AOC. And yeah, you don't get to show up when I'm about to drop 150. I don't care how busty and tall you are. And I'm a man of principle, folks. That was our last date. And she showed up late, so we had the worst seat in the house, even though I had been there like a half hour early when they instructed us to be there. And we're laughing. And then Dane Cook does this thing. Have you ever slept with a woman whose vagina looks like the curtains on a grade school play? And he just starts mimicking some kid trying to open like the thick velvet curtains. And I was laughing and the crowd was laughing. And this chick gave me such a dirty look. And I was like, oh, I may only be in this comedy game for a year right now, but no, ma'am, you don't get to be tardy and judge my laughter. Good day, ma'am. But that was it. Like Dane Cook, like it was a fun show, and he came out, it was around the time that he came out with the double album Retaliation. And I felt like that was the beginning of the end for him as far as me being a big fan. Not because it was like that double album was such a good gimmick, and it was like a Billboard top 5 album when it debuted. It sold like 200,000 copies or something. He was huge. He was Steve Martin level. You know, Maniscalco, Steve Martin, kind of the big arena kind of comics. But that album, I remember thinking Retaliation, there was a good album in that double album, unlike Thoughts and Prayers, which is a fucking banger from start to finish. But at the same time, Thoughts and Prayers came out. I think I was doing comedy longer when I released my 2018 double album. I was not famous, obviously, but I had more seasoning, and I'm just a prolific writer. But I think Dane Cook was like in that mode of like, he was almost ahead of the game in terms of content. But instead of being like having all these different platforms to put out a bunch of content, it was just, he still only had albums, social, like albums. It was albums and TV appearances. It wasn't TikTok, Instagram, all this. So he couldn't split all his like mid-level mediocre stuff into other platforms where it might be taken to more. He just had to keep putting out specials and movies. The specials got weaker and weaker as he was maintaining this big, like, content production. But I did remember I saw in 2015, he had a Showtime special, his first in a while, I think. He had this one called Isolated Incident. That might have been like 10 years ago already. That I thought was like he was trying to do something different, and I kind of respected him for it, but I just didn't think it was that funny. But then he had a special. What was it called? I think Troublemaker on Showtime in 2015. And I actually thought what I really liked about it was it had a great closer. It really did. It had a great closer because he was talking about dating a woman. I think he's still maybe dating this very young woman, like who was like 19 and he was 46 or something when they started dating. And he got a lot of shit for it. But at the same time, it's like he's a celebrity, and if it's legal, and he didn't fucking pluck this chick from his, you know, his ex-wife, you know, Woody Allen reference. Let it be, I guess. It may not be my cup of tea, but it's like, if it's legal, and I even had a friend who wasn't like a huge fan, but was like, yeah, I think they're still together. Or at least this was like a year or two ago. And he was like, I mean, I think he really does love this woman and it was legal. So like there are some times where you go, maybe gross or whatever, but at the same time, as a comedian celebrity, you know, he's living a sort of, immature, so in many ways, sort of an immature lifestyle. So his lifestyle and personality might appeal more to a younger person in many ways. But that's not even the point of this. Troublemaker, if I'm remembering the title correctly, was actually, I thought, good because it was not Dane Cook trying to be someone else, and it was not Dane Cook trying to write Dane Cook jokes. I felt like some of his mid-level specials after Retaliation were very much like, this is the kind of joke that Dane Cook would write. And I feel like Maniscalco is almost in that place right now where he's so funny and charismatic on stage, but sometimes I watch his more recent stuff and it makes me laugh, but I start to feel like you're so self-aware of the persona that got you famous that it's no longer organically happening. You're kind of going, I am going to write a Maniscalco bit. And Dane Cook was doing a lot of, and I just went to see Maniscalco a year and a half ago or whatever, live for a lot of money, and I enjoyed it. So this isn't me saying like, fuck him. I'm just saying, you, as somebody who really watches and loves comedy and watches a lot of it, and I really watch and support and buy the things of comedians that I really like, it's only because I've seen Maniscalco, you know, six specials and seen him live, both worked with him and seen him live as a customer, that I can say that. It's not me saying this as a hater. It's me saying this as somebody who's observed and enjoyed his comedy for a long time. And with Dane Cook, it felt like the same thing, that he was writing, I'm going to write a Dane Cook joke, instead of just letting your voice come out organically. And I thought Troublemaker was the first thing I saw where it was like, I think I wrote on social media, I was like, if you don't like Dane Cook, then you're not going to like Troublemaker. But if you're like me, somebody who was a fan and then kind of faded away, I think you're going to really like what this special is about. So, and it had a great closer, as I said. I laughed. I smiled at a lot of the special, but I laughed at the closer. But he's kind of faded a little bit. I'm sure he's still rich, and unfortunately, I think his brother, his half-brother, like, stole $10 million from him, which is just fucking disgusting. But I've come to appreciate Dane Cook, regardless of his comedy, but for what he represents in comedy. So I feel like instead of, that's why I want to do some of these things, talk about comedians, movies, things over the next like 2 months that I really like and think deserve more respect in the comedy world or in the world in general for its comedy. And Dane Cook, the reason I picked him first was a few things. Karen, I saw this on TikTok. He was making fun of Karens in like 2004 or 2002 or some shit. He was talking, and I thought it was so funny. He just said, every group of women, there's a Karen, and Karen sucks. And I'm like, Karen is now, like, Dane Cook should have trademarked Karen as an insult, because now it is like the insult for a white woman. And he was on that shit like two decades ago. And I just thought to myself, and I was like happy that that TikTok woman, probably somebody my age who was like, when I was in college, I fucked Dane Cook in Philadelphia and I love him. And now she's like a mom who's like, we need to give Dane Cook his, like now she's responsible. And she's like, yes, this isn't about how I banged Dane Cook. This is about, we need to give Dane Cook his respect for his prescient thoughts on Karen. So that was the first thing. Then in the Patrice documentary, which I recommend people watch, in the Patrice O'Neill Comedy Central documentary, which I enjoyed greatly, Dane Cook, first of all, was walking around with a video camera in 1992 at like Boston Mike's, like chronicling his journey. Like Dane Cook, regardless of what you think about his comedy, was almost still ahead of his time, even though he became a monster on MySpace and used websites and social media before they were even as useful as they are today. He was so ahead of the game that it helped make him go from a headliner to a superstar. His usage of MySpace and his website was like so ahead. Like his website basically, you know, I remember looking at it when I was trying to find my first website. It was so slick. It was like a major corporation's website. It was just cool and graphics. And I remember contacting his web designer because I was just like, I contacted Gary Gulman's web designer also, and that's how I got hooked up with my web designer who's been doing my website since 2006, Steve Axworthy, worthyconcepts.com, if you're looking to create a website. you know me, I'm not looking to do one of those like, go to Wix where we'll just give you a plug. Like, I like the work Steve does. It's personalized. He's fast. So there's a plug. If you're in the business for trying to start a website for your career, for your company, I recommend worthyconcepts.com and my guy, Steve Axworthy, who actually was one of my two guests when I did the Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson way back when. He and my then brief 4-month manager before the company fired him and then dumped me, all for crushing on Ferguson. My reward for crushing on Ferguson was to be a man without a manager for the rest of my life. But yeah, so Steve was one of my two guests because I didn't have any friends in LA, and my at the time, my then girlfriend was, as I would learn later, being propositioned by her a septuagenarian mentor at a law firm. So there you can, offline, you can dig into this. If we ever have a drink at a bar at a live show, we can get into all that. The defining year of my comedy existence, 2000, well, we'll leave it out. But the defining year of my comedy existence, when I went from a happy-go-lucky impersonator to a man whose soul had been torn asunder, and decided that nothing would be off limits anymore, introspectively or societally, when it comes to humor because of that year. But anyway, guys, let's talk about other things. Let's go back to Dane Cook. In the Patrice O'Neill documentary, he does an interview, and I could tell he was being sort of diplomatic, but he was talking about Patrice in the context of his time with Opie and Anthony. Anthony Cumia being a deplorable bigot, with his own little network that I have refused to go on repeatedly. Not his show. He would never have me. He blocked me on Twitter because I was unhappy with him calling a black woman a savage animal because they had gotten into an altercation and he was going off and talking about his guns and he seemed like a dangerous scumbag. And as it turns out, my instincts were very correct. But he was on that show, which did give a very big platform to a lot of comedians. They tended to, the ones who really thrive, tended to skew towards the cringe, vulgar, but talented nonetheless. And Patrice, I always felt like, as I looked at that crew and heard how they talked about black people and the kind of political views they had and their societal views, I was always like, is he just a mascot? Is he just their, like, you know, is he just their black guy that they will always, like, they always use him as like, no, I see everybody equally. Patrice was one of my guys. So, you know, and the way Dane Cook talked about it, he was very diplomatic, but I could see insight and heart in what Dane Cook was saying. And he kind of said something to the effect of, I just thought that Patrice was more than just, you know, like the outspoken, loud black guy for the show. And he was being diplomatic, but I think if Dane Cook off mic were to say it, he'd be like, he's so much better and smarter than just being the loud black guy for a bunch of funny racists, is what I felt was coming through between the lines, reading between the lines of what Dane Cook was saying. And it made me respect, I just had a nice respect because he was the only one who spoke on that about that in that way on the special when they were going through his like Opie and Anthony years. He was the only one who I felt like was skating around the issue of like those guys were made, you know, I think he was better than them, not just comedically, but maybe as a person, he deserved a better crew than what they, and I just, could I be wrong? Yes, but I don't think I'm wrong. So it made me sort of go, okay, Dane Cook, I like that. And then, so, and once again, this is not like some groundbreaking segment I'm doing. I thought about making this just an offshoot, like, hey, bonus episode for free for everybody. You know what I mean? For going forward. But I thought, I don't know if I can sustain all these topics for like an hour. So like you get 20 minutes. But the last thing is that he was in a rivalry, as my friend in LA would tell me, with Chris D'Elia, who had kind of, Chris D'Elia is like the, and I've always thought this about his comedy. See, unlike Dane Cook, I'll admit, I can rip on Dane Cook, but I'm not going to pretend like I didn't like him. Just the same way, I will tell you, when people rip on Nickelback, and I forget who said this, somebody on like the Rewatchables, my two favorites are Shea Serrano and Van Latham. I love those two when they do the Rewatchables with Bill Simmons. Those are my two favorite guys on that show by far. But one of them, I think it might have been Van Latham, said, yeah, everybody acts like Nickelback ain't shit, But how you remind me, and I always say this, I'm like, yeah, there's two songs by Nickelback that I genuinely like and really like to lift weights to. How You Remind Me, there's a reason it passed Fly by Sugar Ray as the most played song in like radio history in 2002 or whatever year it was big. And Burn It to the Ground, which I heard on NHL 10 on PlayStation 3, is a Nickelback song. And it's just classic big drums, heavy guitars, rock. And it's just become this cliche to hate Nickelback. But I'm always like, nobody fucking hated Nickelback in 2001 when How You Remind Me was literally like just, I've been down to the battle. Like everybody fucking dug that shit. Not every, but every, it was like very popular. Nobody was like, fuck these guys. And then it just became a thing where it was like, yeah, fuck them. And I'll admit, like, I'll be like, yeah, I have like two or three Nickelback songs on my iPod. And I have two Dane Cook albums. So I'm not going to sit here and be like, Dane Cook was never funny. There are people who never thought he was funny, and that's okay. But I'm not going to pretend to be one of those people. But Chris D'Elia is one that I always was like, I don't get it. I feel like I'm watching, and maybe this is just Chris D'Elia is like almost the, and I'm not getting into Chris D'Elia's accusations or anything. I'm just talking about him as a comic. Chris D'Elia was one of those guys where I was like, he did make me laugh on an episode of Adam Carolla when he was doing this like bad but really funny Jean-Claude Van Damme impression. I actually laughed a lot and I was like, oh good, like maybe D'Elia would be funny to hang out with, but just I don't dig anything he does on stage, and I'm also not a barely legal or a barely illegal girl. I always thought Chris D'Elia seemed like maybe this was the beginning of the de-evolution of comedy, where it was like, wait, so we just actually are promoting a worse, sort of dumber Dane Cook? That's weird. Like, he's like a bet, like, he's like Dane Cook for dummies, and he's the dude. And my friend in LA had told me there was like a big rivalry between them in terms of like they were competing for the same supremacy, I think, at the Laugh Factory, a club that I think Dane Cook had like co-owned at one point. He became so fucking monstrous there. And I just thought to myself, I was like, yeah, Dane Cook never, as far as I know, Dane Cook had no sex scandals. Dane Cook had no, and he was getting puss left and right. Like that dude was fucking like a rock star. Like every, I remember one of the great compliments I got was my first year in comedy doing when I was hosting in 2004, just after taking the bar exam, I went back to DC to host a week, my first paid week at a comedy club, August 2004 for Gary Owen. One of the biggest killers I've ever seen on stage. The, if you're asking who are my three biggest killers and you're new to this podcast, Patrice O'Neill, Sebastian Mascalco, Gary Owen. Three biggest kills I've ever seen at a comedy club, all at the DC Improv. All in different years, but tremendous stuff. And the fourth, even though he didn't kill as hard, my fourth favorite watching for the first time was Tone Bell at the Cleveland Improv. I was just blown away by how funny that guy, his special that he did on Showtime didn't, I felt like had some funny bits, but didn't do justice, as often specials don't, to the live experience. And I felt like some of the bits he did that were crushing in Cleveland, he didn't even do on his special. But the fuck was I talking about? Brain fart. Crushing at the DC Improv. Hosting. Oh, well, and the sound guy at the time came up to me after that week and he said, this is my, you know, this is just to give you an idea of what even MC JL at 25 was capable of. He said, the only guy, one of the great compliments I've ever gotten in my comedy career, and has nothing to do with comedy, but you just got to envision JL with all that humor, but with veiny arms because he works out constantly in a good summer tan. The guy said, the only guy I see getting as much lady attention as you at this club is Dane Cook. Can you imagine that? This, we're talking legend in his prime, Dane Cook, who's just getting Motley Crue at level ass, and little old me out of the MC spot. So what you know about that? Okay, don't judge me just because I'm a bitter fat podcaster now. We're going to get back. You're going to see me at your clubs in 2029, and you're going to be like, JL, you are 50, but you look good for 50. but Dane Cook was banging ass and taking names, and you didn't hear any scandals like this. You didn't hear it. Like the biggest scandal he was in was when he was like 46 dating, like in a serious relationship with like a 20-year-old. And last time I checked, that's totally legal. And a goofy comedian who makes weird hand gestures is probably the most appropriate man in his 40s to date a 20-year-old. Even if you feel like it's per se inappropriate, he's probably the closest thing to a guy who would be able to relate to a 20-year-old. So I think that all in all, I think he was a good choice for the first JL Defends comedy subject. I think we need to, you know, the same way we revisit other people, whether it's like Keanu Reeves in 1999 told a guy to fuck off when he tried to grope a woman's ass. And we're like, Keanu Reeves has been real from day one. I think for all the shit we give Dane Cook, where we put him in that, that Nickelback type level of disrespect, I think it's time for this podcaster and for the comedy world at large to look at the body of his work. And the way he's conducted himself, and I've tried to give you some evidence of that throughout. You know, the Patrice documentary gave me a little more, just a little extra, and that TikTok I saw reminded me of his pioneering usage of Karen as an insult. I think we need to revisit Dane Cook's legacy and realize that, you know what? In a world that embraces quality comedy and people who've done good things in comedy and not abuse their status in comedy, I think Dane Cook seems like that. Even if he's not your favorite comedian, he was an original, and he, you know, what we've seen come after him and the way he's conducted. I think as somebody who's mocked Dane Cook, in fact, if you Google my YouTube video, Dane Cook auditions, JL Covan, Dane Cook auditions, you'll see me making fun of him auditioning for a variety of movies in 2009. But I don't ask for an apology because I was doing comedy. But I say, Dane Cook, you have the righteous prick's respect, even though I have been disrespectful to you in the past via comedy. So there you go, Dane Cook, your first successful defendant by JL. So that's it for this week, guys. So please, hope for Haiti, whatever else I told you, the Malcolm Gladwell video and hope for Haiti. Those are your assignments if you choose to accept them. Thank you for listening. And remember, use that Podomatic. Follow the Podomatic link. You can, you know, you go to my website, jlcomedy.com, and you go to the podcast, and there's a Spotify, Apple, and Podomatic link. And you go to the Podomatic link, you become a follower there, and that will become our sort of weekly chat room. Okay, at least chats where I see all your comments, because they don't display all the comments, but I see all of them. So leave your comments there. It helps the engagement of the podcast. And if you have suggestions or thoughts, by all means, please include them there. And in the show notes, I will include my link for Hope for Haiti, my personal fundraising page for that. So I hope you can be generous this week or this month. You know, we'll revisit a possible Patreon-esque system next month, but I'm inclined to say no. I would just ask that you give to the charity and that you engage, with the podcast via social media. And we see if we can maybe make that have value instead of just begging you for dollars, because you're already, if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably already a fairly good engaged fan, and I thank you for that. So thanks for listening, guys. Stay safe, get vaccinated if you can, and I will see you next Tuesday.